This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Veronica Rickert is off this week. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check out a new museum in Wisconsin that's making connections between the Harlem Renaissance and the Midwest. First, after more than a decade of negotiations, Iran and six world powers last night reached what appears to be a historic framework agreement on Iran's nuclear program. Under the deal, Iran will make significant cuts to its nuclear capabilities and allow nuclear inspections in exchange for a lifting of international sanctions. This is not a completely done deal, but it sets the guidelines for final details to be ironed out over the next few months. With us now is Lara Jakes, Deputy Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Lara, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
So the initial reaction here from a lot of people is this is more detail than we'd expect in this framework. Is that right?
Well, it is, but that's because there had been such low expectations within the last couple of days. What we had heard was that there might be a one-page kind of explainer or, hey, we're open to continuing to negotiate. But this is the type of detail that I believe the United States and most of the world powers had been pushing for some time. And it was perhaps Tehran that did not want to get nailed down or locked down into many specificities at this point. But again, there was a fair amount of surprise yesterday afternoon when journalists found out that what was agreed to yesterday, even if tentatively, was pretty specific.
Now, given that there is that specific detail, in broad strokes, how would this exchange of relaxed sanctions for restricted nuclear activity actually work?
Well, first, it's important to note that none of this will actually probably happen until after June 30th, which is the final deadline for a comprehensive deal. So from here until June 30th, they're going to work out some of the things that we don't know yet, i.e. the pace, how some of these things will be carried out, the cost of them. But pretty much what it comes down to is that Iran has agreed to dilute, ship, or otherwise get rid of something like 98% of its enriched uranium. And that's really key here because enriched uranium is what's used to make a nuclear weapon. So they are going to pledge to get rid of almost all of it. They're going to decommission what are called centrifuges. Centrifuges are what make enriched uranium. They're going to only keep about 5,000, maybe 6,000 of about 19,000 centrifuges they currently have. They're going to decommission or scale back nuclear activity at some of their more troublesome nuclear facilities around Iran. Only one facility will still be allowed to do enrichment programs, and then only at a very limited capacity. And then the big one here for Iran is that it is no longer going to do nuclear activity at a secret underground bunker called Fordo. And the reason why this is important is because it was kept hidden from most of the world for a very long time. And it's kind of the root cause of so many of the suspicions of Iran's nuclear program. In other words, that Iran had said it was on the up and up. And it wasn't until later when the West found out that Fordo was operating that there was huge reason and huge fear to not trust Iran and its program. And so in exchange, Iran has secured a tentative agreement from the United States and from the European Union to start relaxing some of its sanctions. The sanctions went up in place over the past 5 years, but it was really in 2012 that the harshest sanctions were put into place. And they really cratered the economy around Iran. And they gave rise for the election of President Hassan Rouhani in 2013, who swept into office promising some relief from these sanctions. Now, once that is done, and once the IAEA, which is the United Nations inspection arm, comes in and verifies that Iran has taken some of these steps, then the UN will start easing some of its own sanctions that have been in place since 2006. I know this is horribly complicated, but these are pretty big steps for both sides to take. It was a surprise that so many concessions were made.
And that last point seems key from the perspective of the outside powers, that the embargoes aren't relaxed until after there's verification that Iran has done those things that you listed at the outset.
That's right. The IAEA has not had or has not felt like it has had a lot of visibility about what's happening in Tehran over the last, like you said, decade. And so the IAEA is going to have to verify that Iran has taken steps to scale back its nuclear program before the sanctions will be relieved.
We're talking to Lara Jakes from Foreign Policy Magazine about this new deal in the works with Iran. Lara, you've reported on the Middle East for a long time. Part of what the world's watching for here is the reaction from Iran, hardline leaders, and the public in general, which can be harder maybe to read. What do you make of what you've seen from Iran in response to this deal?
Well, it's been interesting. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has not yet come out and made a statement on this. President Rouhani today said that this deal benefits everybody. It was interesting to me that some of his rhetoric sounded very much like what President Obama has said. He said that this is going to be an opening of Iran to the rest of the world, and that's something that we've heard from the White House in recent years as well. Some of Iran's hardliners are upset over what they consider deep concessions in this deal. We'll have to see to what extent the Ayatollah Khamenei agrees with them or listens to them and kind of hews to their fears. But on the streets in Tehran and elsewhere, what we're hearing is that people are interested to see how this is all going to play out. I think it's also fair to say there's a fair amount of bemused skepticism over how much of a relief they are going to see. I mean, they're not very unlike people here in the United States that hear of news of a big deal and wonder, hey, what is this going to mean for me? So we're hearing that already. We're also hearing that some business members and some students in Iran are really looking forward to greater exchange with the West, and they believe that this deal was a necessary first step towards getting there.
With the economic embargo having an impact on daily life in Iran, broad strokes, public opinion, did people tend to blame the outside powers for imposing these embargoes or their own government for pursuing nuclear weapons leading to those embargoes?
You know, I don't think it was really an either or thing. I mean, Iranians are pretty proud people. They're many nationalistic people. But I think one should really look at the 2013 elections when former President Ahmadinejad was voted out of office. He was seen as a hardliner. I attended some of the negotiation sessions when he was in power, and the Iranian negotiators did not budge. They did not want to work with the West. Then in 2013, you saw President Rouhani come in and he said, listen, I hear you. I understand that your lives are hurting. I understand that the economy has really affected so many of my people. And we are going to try to get those lifted so we can, you know, have some economic peace here. And so, again, not too unlike what you hear from U.S. leaders who know that their publics want to have economic respite.
Another world leader very interested in this, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He had warned of bad deals when he visited Congress earlier. He says this is a bad deal. It's a threat to Israel. What do you make of his reaction? Does he have the power to make this deal not go through by the end of June?
Well, that's interesting. You know, you're right. He did say that this deal will threaten the survival of Israel. He and President Obama spoke yesterday. He made his views very clear. I believe the White House said that President Obama was more conciliatory and said, we are not going to let any part of this deal threaten Israel's security or any other part of the world. Now, whether Netanyahu can now go ahead and convince members of Congress to either reenact sanctions on Iran, or even just to take the ability to have a full up or down vote on whether this deal should go through. Those seem to be the two prevailing bills in Congress right now that might put an end to this deal. We're going to have to see if Netanyahu can convince enough Republicans to go through that. The Senate is a little slimmer of a majority than the House, obviously, and there will need to be a fair amount of Democrats who are willing to side with Republicans against the White House in order for a deal like that to go through.
So that's one of the potential obstacles. As we've said, this is a framework, a preliminary understanding. What has to happen now between now and June 30th for this to be a done deal?
Well, I mean, we're getting down to very technical details. You will see experts go in, nuclear experts, economic experts go in and try to figure out how to unwind some of these things. We'll see more inspectors go in and see what they will need to look at to make sure that Iran can hit those benchmarks for easing or limiting their program. On the Western side, you know, the sanctions that have been put in place and have been in place for several years are kind of this tangled web. They're very they're very difficult to try and untangle on a moment's notice. And so they're going to have to really work to do that. And it's very unclear whether they're going to be able to lift sanctions immediately on June 30th.
Supposing this does happen as planned right now, do you see this as maybe potentially leading to a thaw between the U.S. and Iran in the years to come?
I do, actually. I think that President Rouhani's election in 2013 and a meeting or a phone call he had with President Obama at the sidelines of the UN General Assembly that year was a first step. This is certainly the most significant step. And I do believe it signals some more willingness between these states that have been enemies for decades, for a generation, since 1979 and the revolution, that could lead to a greater understanding.
Lara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Lara Jakes. She's Deputy Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine, talking about this new deal with Iran. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's newest museum opened last week, exploring a period of American history that saw a huge cultural and artistic explosion in New York City centered around the neighborhood of Harlem. The Harlem Renaissance Museum, located in Madison, looks to tell the story of that time and showcase connections and ties that the movement had to the Midwest. Joining us now is David Hart. He is one of the co-founders of the Harlem Renaissance Museum. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, first, why did you feel it was important to tell the story of the Harlem Renaissance here in Wisconsin?
Well, the Harlem Renaissance is one of America's most fertile artistic periods. And the story is important for all of us. It was important to tell the story here in Madison because we believe that Madison is has a wonderful artistic community and a supportive one, and one that can support such an effort. But what's more, it was important for us to choose a location that symbolically indicated or sent a signal to the rest of the world that the Harlem Renaissance was a universal a movement, and what better place than in the heartland of Wisconsin and of the nation than to do this.
And can you tell us the origins here? How did the idea for this museum come to be?
Sure. I belong to a nonprofit arts collective, and we host poetry readings, prose readings, workshops, and we wanted to leave a more lasting impact on the arts community here in Madison and the nation. And we everything that we do is centered, steeped, bathed in the Harlem Renaissance arts. And it was just a natural progression. So everything that we have done for the last 12 years has been a natural progression for this museum. That's how it simply came to be.
Can you tell us some of the major figures to come out of the Harlem Renaissance, the ones whose work lives on in a lot of ways till today?
Certainly, some of the more well-known figures, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, some of Du Bois, Alan Locke, James Weldon Johnson, but even some of the more lesser known and those are some of those the individuals that we are focusing on in the museum. Many of them who left their roots in the Midwest to move to Harlem to create and be alongside of the other artists in the Harlem movement.
And some of the names you just mentioned, there's music, there's fiction, nonfiction, essay, poetry, visual
Absolutely.
Art. Are you trying to reflect that breadth of creation in the museum that happened in the Harlem Renaissance?
Absolutely we are. So the museum is a multidisciplinary, multifaceted museum. There, our opening exhibit is called Harlem in the Heartland, and it does feature the individuals, many of the individuals who have Madison and Wisconsin ties, but also Midwest ties, and left to go to Harlem. But in addition to the visual exhibit, we also have several live exhibits, which include all of the arts of the Harlem Renaissance: poetry, prose, writing, jazz, comedy, even a little bit of that, and some dance.
We're talking to David Hart, one of the co-founders of the new Harlem Renaissance Museum in Madison. David, I want to get into some more of those connections in this Harlem and the Heartland exhibit. Can you tell us what we see in the museum about Harlem and the Heartland?
Certainly. We have such a reverence for Gene Toomer, the individual who is largely considered the father of the Harlem Renaissance, the first author of the Harlem Renaissance, who ushered in the movement. He wrote part of his first book called Cain here in Madison, Wisconsin, while he was attending the university. But he came back in the 30s, in the early 30s, married his first wife, had his first child in Portage, and ran what is largely considered to be the first hippie commune in Portage. It was called the Portage Experiment, and so we, in our Heartland exhibit, we are paying a great deal of attention to Toomer and the papers that he maintained here or had here in the state, as well as the letters that he wrote back and forth across the country from here. The State Historical Society has been very gracious and kind in allowing us to take a look and have those on display here in the museum. But there's also a tribute to Toomer and all of the other Midwest artists, or the artists who came from the Midwest as well.
Yeah, I saw those letters there. What do they tell us about Gene Toomer and how this artist, part of the Harlem Renaissance, worked in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, first, I think the letters show that he's a human, that he was a human, and he had, in addition to a great many successes, he had a lot of trials and tribulations, including his own struggle with racial identity. I think the letters indicate that he was a lover of the written word. He was an individual who was very spiritual. I think the letters also indicate the tie to the Harlem movement in many respects. But most, most pointedly that simply that he is just a very very skilled writer, and much of what he wrote here just really set the tone for the movement in the future.
Who were some of the other figures from the Harlem Renaissance who had a strong Midwestern connection?
Sure. Langston Hughes was born in the Midwest. Josephine Baker, Alan Locke taught here in the city for a period of time. Those are all individuals that touched the Midwest. There are several others, but those are the major figures, or the figures that we took a look at.
And there's art there now on display, contemporary, yes, and modern day images of a lot of the figures of the Harlem Renaissance. Can you talk about that exhibit a little?
Yes, sir. Martel Chapman, who is a board member of the museum, he's also the artist in residence who put together the visual and creative piece of the exhibit. They are renderings from anything from Gene Toomer to Josephine Baker to Jack Johnson, but it just gives a really good slice of 1920s life in Harlem, and it's just it's a very visceral and appealing piece and exhibit. I we're very pleased with it.
And David, as we wrap up, we've been talking about the past a lot here, but there have been a lot of issues with racial tensions, Wisconsin, around the country lately. How much are you trying to have this museum look at current events, what's happening today, and current art for that matter?
We believe that we can be proactive in those issues in a non-threatening atmosphere, an artistic atmosphere. We do have a small, quiet tribute to our dear friend Tony Robinson, who of course lost his life. We have a small tribute in the museum, and that it will hang there, and we'll find a more permanent way to honor him. But in addition to that, we believe that we can address those issues in a more non-threatening, creative, and artistic space where everybody feels comfortable talking about these issues.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's David Hart. He's one of the co-founders of the new Harlem Renaissance Museum in Madison. It opened last month. It's looking to showcase the movement's connections to the Midwest. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back on Monday. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, is off this week. It is spring, and it's maple syrup season. While I tend to think of maple syrup as something, you know, pour over the pancakes, the waffles, if I'm feeling zany, ice cream, our next guest says its flavors add a new wrinkle to a lot of different recipes, like tenderloin, Brussels sprouts, chicken, even cocktails. With us now for Food Friday is Brett Laidlaw. He's author of the book Trout Caviar, Recipes from a Northern Forager. He blogs at Trout Caviar, and he also taps his own maple syrup. Brett, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, before we get to recipes, how is your maple syrup running so far?
It's been really on and off this year. I haven't tapped a lot of trees this year, but it started off looking like it was going to be a pretty great year, and then the temperatures got too warm for a few days where they weren't dropping down below freezing at night, which is a necessary thing to happen for the sap to really flow. I had three or four decent days, and it's been kind of just barely trickling lately.
And how much sap do you need to collect for, you know, a jar of maple syrup, a pint or something?
Well, the standard ratio that people tend to use with maple syrup, sap to syrup, is it's about 40 to 1. So 40 units of sap to that same amount of syrup. I tend to find that I get a little better yield than that, and most people that I know do a little better than 40 to 1. But for a quart, you'd need about 8 to 10 gallons of sap to start with.
And is there something to having your own maple syrup? Does maple syrup from Brett Laidlaw's tree taste different than the person down the road or the person a county over?
I have to think that it does. You know, these trees are drawing up that particular groundwater through their roots and passing it through the sapwood of those particular trees. It has to have a particular flavor. And I know that that the syrup that I've made from my own trees definitely has a different taste from what you can buy in the stores. Even if it's a local product, the people who are doing it commercially are generally buying sap from a number of different places in their area, so it gets to be a bit more of a generic product in that case. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Still, pure maple syrup is still great, but that local stuff from your own property definitely, I think, has a distinctive flavor.
So most of us, I'll speak for myself here, I'm probably never going to tap my own maple syrup. So can you make the case, you just said pure maple syrup, a case for, if we're going to use it for cooking or whatever, getting the real stuff, accepting no substitutes to real maple syrup.
Yeah. Well, I should start by saying that I'm the son of Canadians. Both of my parents were from Winnipeg. And
it's
so
on your flag there. You got to have the real
the
stuff.
The land of the maple leaf. And it was drummed into us from a very early age that pure maple syrup has absolutely nothing to do with that pancake syrup, be it Aunt Jemima or the beloved Mrs. Butterworth. So it is, it's a totally natural product. It has one ingredient. It's maple sap that's boiled into syrup. There's nothing else in it, nor can there be, I think, most places by law. So it cannot be replicated by any chemical process or, you know, whatever you want to do with your high fructose corn syrup, your dyes and your flavors and your shapely bottles. It's not the same thing.
We are talking about maple syrup and cooking with maple syrup on today's edition of Food Friday. Forager and maple tapper Brett Laidlaw is with us. Well, let's get into cooking. In your book, Chowed Caviar, you use maple syrup for a lot of different stuff. First, open us up to the idea of maple syrup not as a topping, but as an ingredient.
Right. Well, you can use maple syrup any place you want something sweet. I mean, because whatever the other flavors are that you detect in real maple syrup, it's unquestionably an extremely sweet product. So if you want to add a little bit of sweetness to, well, often you want to balance the acidity in a vinaigrette, say, with a little sweetness. Maple syrup is great for that. Another really common use is in marinades for meats or even fish. You again might want a kind of sweet sour balance to a marinade or a glaze if you're grilling meats. So it's extremely versatile because, you know, it can replace sugar, honey, molasses, any other sweet element that you might generally, you know, find more commonly called for in recipes.
Well, let's get into some recipes now. One that you sent us, maple ramp marinated chicken paillards.
Right.
I think I'm saying that right. We've got this one, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'd go with paillard. That,
all right. First of all, what is a paillard?
Well, it's something flat.
Yeah, it sounds better than flat thing.
It's a flat piece of meat, and usually I think in French cooking it's a chicken thigh that's had been boned, have the bone removed, and then you just wail away at it with something flat and heavy to flatten it out, so you get a nice, fairly even. It's, you know, kind of the scallopini process, but not quite so thin as that. But you just want to get it kind of thin-ish so that it cooks more evenly. In this case, we're grilling it. And in that recipe, I combine maple syrup, which as a forager, thinking about going through the year and, you know, what foods come first, the maple syrup is really the first thing to happen, because even though it's well, you can drink maple sap, and it's pretty delicious in its own right. It's cold and a little bit sweet and slightly woody tasting. But the syrup you make from it is like the first thing that comes up in the wild foods year. And one of the next thing that comes up is ramps, those wild leeks or wild onions that have become the darling of many a gourmet chef in recent years. So I thought it was nice to combine the maple syrup and the ramps in a marinade for these chicken thighs. So it's a really simple recipe. There's a little bit of lemon juice in there. You're always, with something as sweet as maple syrup, you're always looking to balance that sweetness with something on the other end of the spectrum. So the chicken thighs get a simple marinade of the syrup, some lemon juice, some chopped ramps. I don't think there's much else in there. Hmm. And then they just go on a nice hot fire and get a nice crispness and a glaze on them from the maple syrup.
And does the maple syrup kind of caramelize on there as you're grilling?
It does. It does, yeah. So you want to watch it anytime you're grilling with any kind of sugar in a glaze or marinade. You want to keep a close eye on it and probably not have your meat too close to the fire. But I do find that maple syrup, maybe because it's cooked in a sense, it's boiled is how it's made. You're reducing all that sap into syrup. It seems to me that it tends not to burn as easily as if you use, say, honey or just straight sugar in a marinade or glaze. So that's an advantage when you're grilling with maple syrup also.
So between the chicken thigh, the ramps, the maple, the lemon, it sounds like it's got a probably kind of a rich and maybe a smoky flavor from the maple?
Well, yeah, and from the fire.
Well, right.
it's a lovely, simple, and seasonal dish. And I had somebody, this is a bold claim, I don't make it myself, but somebody reading the blog made the recipe and said it was the best grilled chicken they'd ever had.
Wow.
So there's a testimonial out there for you.
So that's something I'd want to try, but say there aren't ramps around, I'm not growing them myself, I don't find them, I'm not a forager, I'm not at the farmer's market. Could I
sure.
make do with leeks or scallions or something like that?
Absolutely, yeah. Leeks, scallions, shallots, pretty much any onion component could fill in for the ramps with, and maybe I always find that there's a garlicky element to ramps, so you could add a little bit of garlic along with whatever other onion component you chose to replace the ramps with.
And when you're doing a marinade with maple syrup, how long do you usually let it marinate for to really get that flavor soaked in there?
Well, with something like the chicken paillards, where there's a lot of surface area, a couple of hours is sufficient. Probably you could do it overnight and refrigerate it, or do it for a couple of hours at room temp. Yeah, if you're going to leave it at room temp, I wouldn't do it for more than a couple of hours. Refrigerate it if you're going to do it for longer than that.
We're talking about cooking with maple syrup, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you use maple syrup for anything other than the pancakes and the waffles? What do you do with it? What tips would you share? Or do you have a question about a way to make use of maple syrup, whether you buy it at a store or tap and boil your own? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, check out that Maple Ramp Marinated Chicken Paillards recipe. New word in my vocabulary there. We'll pick up our conversation with forager and maple tapper Brett Laidlaw after these headlines with Kristen Durst.
Short stack of griddle cakes, melted butter, maple syrup, lightly heated, slice of ham. Nothing beats the taste sensation when maple syrup collides with ham.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That was Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks dropping some truth about maple syrup. On today's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about maple syrup and some fresh ideas for cooking with it. You're welcome to join in. Do you have a question about maple syrup for our guest, Brett Laidlaw, or a tip or idea to share about cooking with it? Call 800-642-1234. You can share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Get a recipe while you're there. Brett Laidlaw stays with us. He blogs at Trout Caviar. His book is Trout Caviar Recipes from a Northern Forager. Let's go right to a caller. We've got Erica in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Hello.
Hey, Erica.
Hi, I'm just out here cooking sap as we speak. Been at it since about 6 this morning.
Nice.
I was just we get a lot of recipes from the Wisconsin Maple Producers Association, Maple Syrup Producers Association, and we make my honey and I make just a ham glaze like you were talking about, and maple cheesecake that just.
Hmm.
It'll thump your thighs.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Good luck with this year's crop. And Brett, there is something, as Twin Peaks taught us, about the combination of maple syrup and ham and pork product in general. Any good thoughts on cooking in that direction?
I love that little clip. I fully agree. And I should say that I've been smoking my own bacon for the last probably 15 years or so, And the cure for that bacon, that pork belly, is maple syrup and salt. That's it. So I would say probably the majority, or at least the largest single use of maple syrup in my house is in curing pork belly for that home smoked bacon, which is amazingly easy. And the recipe is in my cookbook and on my blog as well. But yeah, I love maple syrup. On ham, on sausage at breakfast, or as a glaze for a pork chop. That's my go-to preparation. Something just as simple as a nice thick cut pork chop, salt and maple syrup, let that sit for a while and then give it a nice smoky grilling. That's hard to beat.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Terry in Waupaca next. Terry, hi.
Hi. I was listening to the show, and I'm right here cooking with maple syrup right now, so I thought I'd call in.
What are you making?
I'm making bacon apple chicken burgers with a maple cranberry sauce using Waupaca maple syrup from Eisentrout Farms.
Oh, man, that
sounds
awesome.
Cranberry and maple together, so you got the sweet and the tart together.
Right, and then the bacon and the apple and the burgers, ugh. Fabulous.
That sounds fantastic, Terry. Thank you. So just, you know, that reminds me of your marinade there with lemon juice and maple. This is cranberry and maple together, Brett.
Right, yeah. As I say, it's often, you know, the balancing the sweetness with something tart, with something tangy, mustard, cranberry, vinegar, lemon juice, wine. Those are all great things to pair with that sweetness, and they create something. It's a greater than the sum of its parts flavor to me, especially when you use maple syrup, which is more than just sweet. It's round and it's deep and it's aromatic. So when you counter the sweetness with something tart, it comes together into a new whole, as it were.
Terry, enjoy those burgers. We are talking about cooking with maple syrup on Food Friday. Brett Laidlaw is with us. Our next caller is Danny in Muskego. Danny, hi.
Hi.
Hey, Danny.
I'm also out boiling my fat in the last of the year. I took off all my buckets yesterday, and I only have four trees in my yard, but I only did three this year. Mm-hmm. I really like to use maple syrup directly on cooked sweet potatoes, maybe a little cinnamon on top of it, too, or in baked apples.
Lovely.
I also use it for sweetening tea. And I prefer to use it over sugar, you know, regular table sugar, because it has only 30% fructose instead of the 50% that's in table sugar.
Uh-huh.
Interesting, Danny. Thanks a lot. So, yeah, can you mostly, Brett, use maple syrup where you would use sugar in maybe cooking, maybe not baking, I'm guessing.
Right. Yeah, in some baking applications as well, you could. We've got a little tartlet recipe up on I don't know if you guys, I think you were maybe going to put it on your website, but it's a recent blog post of mine where maple syrup is used in a tart filling. But yes, to sweeten your coffee, your tea, just about anything in a general cooking application, maple syrup can take the place of white sugar or brown sugar.
And we got an email from Grant who says, I'm a brewer. I've used Wisconsin maple syrup brewing buckwheat maple ale.
Wow.
Now, I know some things, like some flavors don't go through the brewing process, Brett. I don't know if you're familiar with brewing with maple, but would that hold it in there?
I do not know. Okay. That's way outside my realm.
Or maybe that's something where they add maple later. But the taste combination would work, I would think.
I'd love to hear more about that. I like the idea of maple and buckwheat also. That seems very northern, kind of exotically northern.
Yeah, yeah. Grant, you can send a keg care of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here's one here to Eau Claire as well.
Oh, actually, before we get back to callers, the beverage reminds you, you've got a cocktail in your cookbook with maple syrup.
Yeah, I've got a couple of them. I think maybe the one you're talking about is where it's combined with the apple brandy, the Calvados.
Yeah, yeah, it was like a cure, you called it, I think.
Yeah, I love to use them. But we have a lot of apple trees on our property as well as maples, and I find that apple and maple just go together beautifully. And so that cocktail, I think, is just a simple combination of a bit of maple syrup, not too much, some sparkling water, and a little shot of apple brandy. Calvados or good old American Applejack would work equally well.
Let's get back to our callers. We've got Kathy on the line in Fitchburg. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I have a very unusual, I think, use for maple syrup. We were visiting some friends overnight, and the next day my friend made a great breakfast, and her son said, of course maple syrup was on the table, said, can we bring out the cheddar cheese, and proceeded to dip cheddar cheese in maple syrup. And I was astonished, but I tried it, and it's really delicious.
Now, Kathy, how sharp was the cheese, the cheddar?
You know, I think it was kind of just an ordinary, you know, these were kids who were, you know, mm-hmm. in the family. So I think it was kind of an ordinary, like, medium cheddar. But, you know, I even imagine it would be fabulous with a nice sharp cheddar.
Kathy, thanks. I was going to say, Brett, a sharp cheddar would be good. Is that, have you tried this experiment, cheddar and maple syrup?
I haven't tried straight maple syrup on sharp cheddar, but I do often when I serve a... I love the aged Gouda we get from the Marika Gouda in Thorpe, Wisconsin, and I came up with a little apple cranberry relish, including maple syrup, that I like to serve with that. But that idea of serving the straight maple syrup, you know, a lot of times on your cheese plates in the fancier restaurants these days, you'll get a drizzle of honey on cheese, and I hadn't thought of doing that with maple syrup, but I'll bet it would be great, especially if you maybe reduce the maple syrup a bit to give it a little more viscosity, to more like honey-like viscosity. You could drizzle that over a piece of sharp cheddar. That I'm going to try that.
Restaurateurs, take heed there. Sandra, next in Michicot, is with us. Sandra, hi.
Hello. Hey. I wanted to mention that we make our maple syrup, too, from our 20 acres maple woods. And I use it quite a bit in baking. Mm-hmm. I also have the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Cookbook. It has some very good cookie recipes in there that my family likes.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, thanks a lot for sharing that and enjoy those cookies. Brett, as we wrap up, you've tapped some little hit or miss this year. It sounds like, what is your plan? What are you going to do with your maple syrup over the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'll just, you know, keep it on hand in the kitchen, and I reach for it on a very regular basis. So it's there whenever inspiration strikes, really.
All right, Brett, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Rob.
That was Brett Laidlaw with us for Food Friday. He's author of the book Trout Caviar, Recipes from a Northern Forager. We have a maple syrup recipe over at the Central Time Facebook page for the chicken paillards, grilled chicken marinated in maple syrup, among other things. The 1990s continue to colonize the present, at least in the world of TV. We've already heard plans to bring back 90s TV shows or make sequels to them, Twin Peaks, The X-Files, Coach. And now there are reports that Netflix may be signing a deal for a sequel to the sitcom Full House, tentatively titled Fuller House. The person in the world who is most excited about this news is in the studio with me now, Central Time producer Amanda Magnus. Amanda, why are you so excited about this?
Full House ran, they ended their eighth season run in 1995, so it was the perfect time for me to be watching a sitcom about this kind of dysfunctional family with three girls. I was at the perfect age, and I have all these great memories of the show and how wonderful it was, and I basically feel like I grew up with these people.
So you are the perfect target audience here, obviously, with the nostalgia. What are your hopes for what might happen with this new show, for who might show up on it?
Well, right now it looks like, well, according to the rumors, they have Candace Cameron Bure, who played DJ, and Andrea Barber, who played Kimmy Gibbler. They are definitely signed on, according to the rumors. And then John Stamos, Bob Saget, and Dave Coulier are going to come back, too, to reprise their roles, apparently. So I hope it's just as good as the original.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see. We will go out at Amanda's insistence with the theme song from the original Full House. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.